Heavenly King, Comforter, Spirit of Truth, who art everywhere present and fillest all things, Treasury of good things and Giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us of all impurity, and save our souls, O good one. Hello, this is Father John McKeown from Holy Archangels Orthodox Church in Phoenix, Arizona, and this is the first of roughly 13 or so sessions in a class to present the beliefs and practices and teachings of the Orthodox Church for those who may be interested in discovering more about what the Orthodox Church teaches and believes, and also for Orthodox Christians who'd like to have a better understanding or a deeper understanding, at least at some points, of the faith and its practice. The class, as I mentioned, goes about 13 sessions, and its scope is primarily to go from perhaps a basic understanding of Christianity to an understanding of basic orthodoxy, both the beliefs and practices, building on a base that may have been acquired through participation in another church, either a Roman Catholic church or a Protestant church. It's not exclusive. Those people who might not have such a background will still find some things. There may be a little bit that is taken for granted in the presentation in terms of moving from basic Christianity to basic orthodoxy, but I would welcome any questions you may have along those lines. If something is beyond your experience and you'd like to know more about it, please feel free to contact me, and we can get that for you. The class, as it's conceived, has as a starting point an examination of philosophical positions and cultural assumptions, the things that we bring with us when we come in to study any new area, any new topic. It's not taking place in a vacuum. We're not completely blank slates. We have the things that we've learned, whether we realize it or not, perhaps by direct instruction, certainly by experience, or the experience of others that we've learned about, that shapes how we perceive the world around us and the things taking place. And so I've kind of have conceptually broken the class down into two phases. So the first phase being one I call deconstruction, in which we become aware, at least I seek to make us aware, of the cultural barriers that we may have to accepting the claims of the Orthodox Christian faith. There are a lot of things involved in that are not immediately obvious, I think, but experience teaches us that these barriers do exist. And then the second phase, having finished at least an initial deconstruction, to reconstruct things, to understand the teachings and practices of the Orthodox Christian life and faith. These are not immediately obvious, but I hope that by the time we get to the end of the journey with this, you'll have a better understanding. We begin with a walk through history, and I like to begin doing this kind of maybe to illustrate something that may touch your experience as well, my own journey to becoming Orthodox, because I was not, as we sometimes call, a cradle Orthodox. I was not raised in this faith. It's one that I came to as an adult. I was actually raised as a Presbyterian and spent the first, 13 years of my life growing up in that system and learning the teachings there. At the age of 13, due to some circumstances that took place in my family, I became, I would say, an atheist. I was enamored, if you will, of the teaching of the sciences that we were exposed to in school, having reached, around 6th grade by that time, 7th grade. And I had come to a position in which I thought that basically Christianity was nothing more than another aspect of the basic mythologies that you can find from peoples and cultures across time and space. A way to explain the things that are unknown, as the Greeks and the Romans had once done. You know, there was in their systems there was a god of the sun and a god of the moon and a god of the rain and a god of the dead and a god of the sea and a god of this and a god of that, and goddesses along the same lines. And basically, things that took place that fell within the spheres of those different gods and goddesses was attributed to their actions. And they had ways of approaching them and appeasing them and dealing with the situation. And I saw Christianity as, and with Judaism and Islam, as being a kind of a one-stop shopping, that you didn't have to deal with a pantheon of gods and goddesses. You had simply a god that had to be dealt with. But it was still basically nothing more than an inability to explain how things worked, and that we had moved away from having gods of the weather, for example, as we came to understand the transpiration cycle and the influences on the weather that take place. You know, how water evaporates and from standing sources like the sea or from lakes, rivers, you name it, becomes water vapor, and then at a certain time, under certain conditions, it forms into clouds, and then it condenses and returns to the earth as rain, and the cycle is completed. And I thought that basically everything in human life was sooner or later going to be understood by virtue of the sciences. And so I guess I became a believer in science rather than a believer in God. Well, over the course of time, I realized more than anything else that this belief was a belief, that it was based on certain assumptions that ultimately could not be proven, and that basically the only difference between what I believed and what Christians believed had to do with the nature of the God or the power that was behind things. You know, going back, basically the stumbling point for me in terms of my own atheism, which led me at least to an agnosticism, which is a belief in something, was that creation itself is a statement of faith, something that can neither be proven or disproven. It can only be accepted by belief, and then everything flows out of that assumption. Of course, the Christians believe, with the Jews and the Muslims, that God created the heavens and the earth, and that set things in motion in terms of time and space and human existence and everything else that goes on. The scientists were believing in the Big Bang theory. There was this primal atom, and it exploded. It had contained all the matter in the universe, and now that matter is moving apart as a result of this explosion, and so it's taken place over enough time that the galaxies are separated by hundreds of thousands of light years, millions of light years, and out to the farthest scopes of the universe, and everything flows from that. But you can't prove it. There's no way to demonstrate that in a way that can show that this is actually what happened. And of course, that theory is continuing to be questioned, and is evolving and changing and developing and deepening depending on where you stand on the spectrum. But what was critical for me was to realize that I could believe in God or I could believe in the Big Bang, but central to both approaches was faith, was belief. And I decided that rather than believe in something that was nebulous and unknown, I was going to believe in what was revealed by God and what was found in the churches. And that began for me a search for truth, a search for an understanding of God, a search for meaning and purpose in my life and in life in general, which led me to, as I said, an agnosticism, and then at the age of 15 to the Episcopal Church, and I was involved with that church for quite some time, even becoming a priest and serving for almost 5 years as a priest in the Episcopal Church before I realized that there were reasons that I could not escape. Becoming Orthodox, as I became aware of the Orthodox Church, I'd first had found it and had considered it among the historical churches. Certainly it was there from the beginning of the church, and its origins can be traced back directly to the apostles, and through the apostles to our Lord Jesus Christ himself. But that this church continued in existence today, and I really had no reason that I could justify not being a part of it through teachings and reasonings that we can go into later if there's interest for it. So I became an Orthodox Christian, and then becoming Orthodox, I became a deacon, and then later a priest after a period of time of study and examination and evaluation in both directions. Why did I become Orthodox? Well, I was aware of problems in the church where I belonged. Things were being changed, and they were being changed on the basis of a majority vote. This was not how things were done across time and space in the church. It's never been questions of basic belief and practice have never been subject to a vote of the people, if you will, and therefore changeable, actually flip-flopping, going from one direction to the exact opposite direction as a result. And that made me uncomfortable, being part of a system that changed its basic tenets in that way. the more I looked around and considered alternatives, the more I found that the residue of truth that I was seeking and thought I had found in one place was actually in the Orthodox Church. And because that church, which has been around since day one, was still in existence, how could I justify being part of a church that was not under that same teaching authority, not under that same believing authority, but had its own developments, its own history, that contained things that set in motion elements that were contrary to what I thought was important. And so we became convinced that we needed to become Orthodox, and a portion of that was as well an awareness of church history, which we will take up in just a moment. So these are some of the things that were going on for me that led me to become Orthodox and want to make this journey myself, and hopefully that gives me some insights that I can share with you to help you in your journey as well. Well, let's look at church history for a moment. We'll move backwards from today. Now, if you looked in the Phoenix Metro Questex telephone book, as I did when I first began preparing this class, you'll find at least these numbers are approximate. I think I did this search in 2002. I've never felt really compelled to go back and check it on an annual basis. But at the time I put this together, if you went to the Yellow Pages category that says churches, that category itself covered all or part of 22 different pages in that phone book. In those 22 pages, there were approximately 123 different flavors, if you will. Forgive me if it seems to be irrelevant or irreverent, not irrelevant, irreverent to say of denominations calling them flavors. But it's kind of like, I don't know, my sense of humor. It's like looking at ice cream, and there's vanilla and chocolate and strawberry and vanilla fudge and you name it. There's a wide variety of flavors, all of which are ice cream. So if we consider that all these listings in the Yellow Pages of churches as ice cream, then there were 123 different flavors, some of which were not really qualified to be counted as ice cream. In other words, there were some non-Christian groups listed under churches. If you took them out, I think we still had 102 different flavors or 104 different flavors in that listing. And one of the questions that we have to contend with is, why are there so many different kinds of churches, so many different groups of people who believe in our Lord Jesus Christ in one form or another, but whose teachings are different from place to place to place to place? How is that possible? How can that be? Part of this is it's a development over time between different philosophies, responses to different problems that took place in the church before the Protestant Reformation, different understandings, different teachings. And in order to do that, we need to continue looking back across time. And probably one of the pivotal moments in the development of the state of the churches today took place on October the 31st in the year 1517, which is the Protestant Reformation, when that happens to be the date that Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg, Germany, protesting certain teachings of the Roman Catholic Church and setting in motion the world that we see today, where it seems more and more often when you have a difficulty together, you don't reason it out. You can kind of fight it out, and one group leaves and claims to be the true church, and another group stays and claims to be the true church, and they don't like each other anymore, and they don't talk to each other anymore, and so you get a fracturing, and you get all sorts of different combinations of how people put things together in an attempt to stand firm on an issue and something they think is important. And that's not an unadmirable quality. I mean, it's something that we need to do, but the question is, what are we fighting about and over whose authority? But the Protestant Reformation kind of brings us to the situation that we find, where there's 104 different kinds of Christian organizations found in the Phoenix phone book in the year 2002. Well, one of the defining characteristics of the Protestant Reformation that we see exhibited to this very day in that part of the Christian spectrum, that the Protestant church part, is a fundamental definition that says we're not Rome. The Protestant Reformation, in effect, is a splintering of the Roman church into these different groups based on different perspectives, as we said, about what the faith teaches, what the faith requires, how we're supposed to live. That wasn't the first time there was a division in the church. If we back it up some 500 years before that, in the year 1054 is what you'll find written in the history books, or whether church history or general history, if they covers this aspect of sometimes the churches don't get mentioned, what's called the Great Schism, the separation of the church east and west. And we'll go into this in more detail later on. But it basically came down to a conflict between the church in the West and the churches in the East. And I say that because the situation over 1,000 years into the life of the church from its establishment, there were basically five central points, five leaders, five centers responsible for managing or governing the church. And these were the patriarchs. Now, a patriarch is a head of a national church. So what you had historically was the Patriarch of Rome, the Patriarch of Constantinople, the Patriarch of Alexandria, the Patriarch of Antioch, and the Patriarch of Jerusalem. And they were listed in that order in the church canons, church canons being the laws and regulations by which the church governs herself, determined by the leadership of the church, which is invested in the bishops, who are considered to be the successors of Christ in their regional area. So you have a local bishop, for example, in the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia, our particular church grouping in the Orthodox family. We have a patriarch who is in Moscow. We have a metropolitan who is in charge of the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia worldwide. And then under that are the various bishops. We have a diocese of San Francisco in Western America. There's a diocese of Chicago in Mid-America. There's a diocese of New York in Eastern America. There's a diocese of Canada, Eastern Canada, diocese of Western Canada, diocese in Australia, and New Zealand, a diocese in South America, and each diocese has a bishop as its head, and that bishop is the supreme church authority in that area. But the bishops themselves gather together to resolve questions, and usually a metropolitan is in charge of a larger area, and then a patriarch is in charge of a larger area still. So we had those five patriarchates. Well, there was some things that were taking place in history that affected how those five patriarchates worked together in what they did in governing their regions. The Patriarch of Rome, who was first because Rome was the capital of the empire in which the church was established, so the Patriarch of Rome was accorded first speaker status, if you will. He was the head of the church by virtue of being in the imperial city. It was not an authoritative headship, it was a relational headship, a courtesy title, if you will, extended, and basically it meant that he spoke first or he spoke last, depending on how the debate was framed in the course of events where the church is meeting together to deal with issues. Then the Patriarchate of Constantinople had second place because it was the capital of the empire in the east. So both the imperial capitals were represented, and they were represented in order of time. Alexandria was the most important city socially, economically, politically on the African continent. Antioch was one of the important cities in the Middle East. And Jerusalem was a patriarchate. It was not of any particular political or military or economic importance in comparison to the other four. It just happened to be the place where our Lord lived and died and rose again from the dead and ascended into heaven, and so it was given a seat at the top table with the other four. It was also the most ancient of all the patriarchates, because that's where the church began, and it spread forth from Jerusalem into the rest of the world. And so the Jerusalem Patriarchate was an important player in the dynamic of the governance of the early church. Well, The Patriarchate in Rome spoke Latin, naturally enough, not surprisingly at all to hear that that was the language of Rome, because it was the language of the empire. But by the time the Great Schism came to take place, and actually beginning several hundred years before that, were some difficulties because the other four patriarchates were in regions of the empire where the principal language was not Latin but Greek. And a lot of the difficulties that grew up over time came as a result of a difficulty in translating the concepts that were being discussed, the issues that were causing divisions in the church in terms of people leaning one way or leaning the other way, having difficulties in grasping this. And when you have to add in the additional difficulty of taking a concept that is transforming a language and being used in a way that it hadn't been used before in a language, and then try to take it to a different language, that things can get muddled because there may not be a direct corresponding point of view. An example of the situation is there's a Greek term that we use to describe personhood, and that word is hypostasis, and I may not be pronouncing it correctly. That's how I remember it. I'm not sure. I apologize if it's wrong. Hypostasis, being a reference to a person. Well, the Latin corresponding Latin term was prosopon, which is the root from which we get the word persona, and it meant something slightly different in Greek than it meant in Latin, and that led to misunderstandings as these things tried to get worked out, because prosopon was a term in the Latin that referred to an actor putting on a mask and therefore taking on the aspect, speaking as if and behaving as if they were the person that was being depicted in the mask rather than themselves, and that was a sticking point for a while in understanding what the Greek term meant, which was an important distinction. So we have a church in which a portion of the people speak Latin and the remainder speak Greek, and four of the five patriarchs were in the Greek-speaking region. Additionally, the Patriarchate of Rome was in a situation that had no empire, had no central government, because after the year, well, the historians date the fall of the Roman Empire in the year 476 AD. That's the date that the first of the Latin kings took the place of the Roman Emperor in the West, and this had some striking implications for history as well, and that includes the history of the church, because what that meant was prior to that time, the church grew up in an environment where there was an empire with an emperor, in some cases two emperors. There was an emperor in the West and an emperor in the East. And there was a central government that went with that emperor. And so the emperor appointed governors, and they went out to the various regions. And there were armies that were sent to those regions as well to enforce the will of the orders of the governors who were acting on behalf of the emperors. And so there was a central administration for things that was all tied back into Rome. Well, when the Roman Empire as a political entity in the world disappeared and was replaced by the first of the Latin kings, who styled himself as the Roman Emperor but is not historically recognized as such, and in practical matters in that time was not recognized as such by everyone, the only remaining central administrative body after the disappearance of the central government of the Roman Empire was the church. The church had an important aspect in everyday life because they were closely associated with the imperial court. Much of what we see in the vestments today derives from the court dress of the officials of the empire who happened to be members of the church. And why did and the reason why they were members of the imperial court was because it was much more difficult to bribe a bishop or a priest or another faithful member of the church than it was someone who had no moral system or had basically the Roman moral system, which was anything goes. You were more likely to get good administration, more likely to get the administration of justice from such an official. And so over time they had become integrated into the imperial system, and so were the only remnant of that imperial system left in the West. And so the church in the West took on a leadership position that was not directly and immediately tied to the teaching and practice of the faith, but it had to do with other aspects of life as well. This was not the case in the East, which, although we call them the Byzantine Empire to distinguish it from the Roman Empire, the fact of the matter was is that they considered themselves to be Romans, and they called themselves Romans. Even though they spoke Greek, they called themselves Romans. And the leaders spoke both Greek and Latin. That was the essential requirement to be an official in the empire. And we see this carried over in all sorts of ways. For example, the Eastern European country of Romania has as its root, it's Roman. You know, Romania. You can see it, you can hear it, you can, you know, it's there. But that was part of the Eastern Empire, not really part of the Western Empire. So the Byzantine Empire was the Roman Empire Part II, and that continued until the year 1453, almost 1,000 years after the disappearance of the empire in the West. You had an empire in the East, with an emperor, with an army, with a senate, with all the administrative functions being carried out by secular officials and not needing church officials in order to do that. And as a result, an understanding developed between emperor and the patriarchs and the bishops of the harmony of church and state, where the emperor was the supreme ruler in secular affairs, earthly matters, and was supported in his administration by the church. The church acting as a brake, acting as a critic, able to call an emperor to the need to repent and to transform his ways when what he was doing was incorrect, but basically otherwise supporting him as God's appointed ruler of secular matters on earth for administrative and civil discipline. And conversely, the church was supreme in the realm of spiritual matters and was supported in that by the emperor. So this harmony of operation of church and state grew up in the East, which didn't happen in the West because there was no state in the West after the disappearance of the empire in the West. And so this led to differences in the church and the way things were administered. The Pope became, over time, the Pope being the term applied to the Patriarch of Rome. Patriarch means father, Pope means papa. So you can see the relationship. And indeed, in many of the languages of the world, both West and East, Papa, Pope, means Papa. It means, you know, it's a familiar form of address, and so the Holy Father in Rome, the Pope, was simply one of the five patriarchs that governed the church, one of the five leading fathers, the head of the family in that region. That term came to take on a new meaning when applied to him because of the way the circumstances developed, because he became a secular authority, and in fact, the Pope was a political and military leader of some note and distinction into the 19th century, into the time where the modern state of Italy was formed in the 1860s, because running right across the center of the boot of the Italian peninsula were the papal states, and the Pope ruled them as a prince. With the same basic status and stature as the King of England or the King of France or any other monarch. The Pope was a monarch. Those guys in the fancy uniforms you see guiding the Vatican today, the Vatican being a sovereign state completely contained inside the city of Rome, but it is a separate entity. It is its own country. It has its own political administration. It's not part of Italy. It sends out its own ambassadors. There's a papal nuncio representing the Vatican in the Washington Diplomatic Corps, and indeed in other places around the world, because the Vatican remains to this day a sovereign state headed by the Pope. So the guards that you see there are not simply there for decoration and not simply a historical throwback. That was the Pope's army. They were part of the military forces that the Pope had at his command, and at one point the Pope could make or break kings in other lands by means available to him either through the church or through the military exercise of political power. This is not a situation you find at all in the Eastern churches. And so all these things came together in the year 1054 when there was a question that was before the church, and the representative of the Pope in Constantinople walked into the imperial cathedral while the divine liturgy was being celebrated, and reportedly tossed under the table, the holy table, as the patriarch of Constantinople was preparing to bless the bread and wine to become the body and blood of Christ, and he threw the excommunication of the patriarch of Constantinople, ordered by the patriarch of Rome, onto the communion table in the midst of the preparation of the elements. And this excommunication resulted in the Patriarch of Constantinople excommunicating the Patriarch of Rome, starting a family feud that is now 900 and some years old, continuing up to this very day. That is primarily the result of misunderstandings of teachings and a development of situation where basically the Patriarch of Rome looked at the other four patriarchs and said, "When I say jump, you should say how high," and they looked at him and said, "Who died and made you pope?" And so we have this family feud that is now ongoing. That was not the first division in the church. There was a division of the church in the year 431 AD, where as a result of the third and fourth ecumenical councils and teachings over the nature of Christ, the churches in Africa split away, disagreeing over an idea. So go back to the establishment of the church on the day of Pentecost, and traditionally dated in the year 33 AD, you had one church, became two churches in 431, became two more churches in 1054, it became another set of churches in 1517, and that fracturing process has continued up to this day. Well, this has had an impact not only on the shape of the church and the way things take place, in terms of how things are decided in churches today, how they govern themselves, as well as what they teach and practice. It's had an impact on the culture in which we live, because our cultures were shaped not only by the church, but by the socioeconomic and political questions of the day. And our Western culture, in many respects, is significantly different than Eastern culture. And here, by Eastern culture, I don't mean Far East in the sense of the China and Japan and India, going that far, where Christianity is not one of the historic faiths in the way it is as we get into the Near East and Eastern Europe and Western Europe, and then into the Americas, the Western world there. Not talking going that far east, but in that part of the world that might be called Eastern Christian, the culture of having an empire that lasted for an additional 1,000 years, and the development of this concept of the church and state in harmony, as opposed to the Western world, where for a time you could say the church is the state, the church was the state, it was the only central authority remaining. These caused different ideas, different concepts to shape the culture in which we live, and we carry that cultural assumption with us. It's unavoidable, and in some ways it's inescapable, as long as we're not aware of that. Of course, when we become aware of it, then we can make a conscious choice as to whether we want to hold and continue in that pattern or transform it and adopt something different. But that has to be a conscious choice that we make, and that's something that is really not an immediately obvious aspect of making a decision to become an Orthodox Christian as opposed to a Christian in a Western variety, or follow a different faith teaching in system altogether. This is a gross oversimplification made for purposes of trying to highlight the situation, but I've defined essentially a distinction in the cultures East and West as a result of Eastern Christianity and Western Christianity. And in the East, I say of that culture, the style was more philosophical, and they had a great question, which was why. Why are things the way they are? Why has God done this? Why why is it that these things work, why is it that these things don't work. Where in the West, the area that was under the influence of Rome, the style was legal, and the great question was how. How do things work? How is this done? How is this possible? Subtle distinctions, but they make a difference in how you proceed, what happens once you've begun to ask those questions and work on them. It leads you to a different set of appreciations. And one of the ways this thing works itself out over time is to go back. Remember we said of the Protestant Reformation, its central principle, its central defining point might be, we're not Rome. We're not the Roman Church. We are a different church. We don't believe what they believe. We don't do what they do. And so we're not them. Don't be confused. That is adhered to sometimes in a looser and formal way. You have churches in the West today that are almost the same as the Roman Catholic Church in what they teach and in what they do. For example, the Episcopal Church is in many ways very close to Roman Catholicism, although the developments over the last 20 to 30 years, maybe 40 years, are beginning to make that less and less obvious, less and less immediate. But historically, very close, whereas other churches, the Baptist churches and some of the Pentecostal churches, not at all like Rome. But they all, at one point or another, if you go deep enough into their teachings and their organization, they will say, sometimes explicitly, sometimes you have to read between the lines, we're not Rome. All of the Western churches are children of the Roman Church, maybe reacting against it and trying to do their best, like a rebellious child who doesn't want to be identified in any way with his or her parents, but they can't ultimately get away from the parental connection that's there. All the Western churches essentially are, you know, the children of the Roman Catholic Church, but they define themselves as being anything but what their parent is like. This is one of the outgrowths of the way the Western church developed and the Western culture developed under the influence of that whole dynamic of the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant Reformation. We've mentioned in the East the cultural roots there. The Roman Empire there did not fall at the same time as the empire in the West disappeared. You had, as a result, conciliar leadership of the church by the four remaining patriarchates, who remained in consultation with each other, who basically the style of governance in the church at that time was a bishop dealt with the issues inside his diocese. If there were questions, he rendered a decision. If he wasn't sure what the correct answer would be, he consulted with his metropolitan. The metropolitan would make a decision. If the metropolitan wasn't sure, he would consult with his patriarch, and the patriarch would make the decision. And if the patriarch wasn't sure what the answer should be, he consulted with the other patriarchates and said, this is the question we have in our area. How are you, you know, is that happening for you? How do you deal with it? How would you deal with it? And they consulted together and made a decision and then passed that along, and that became the teaching of the church over the areas within their jurisdiction. In contrast, in the West, you had the Western Empire disappear and the church taking on a lot of secular functions because it was the remaining central authority, which eventually led to the leadership of the church in the West by the one patriarch, who in effect took on many dictatorial aspects. And the Western culture also has something that helped shape and define the church, politics, all sorts of other social institutions, in that it was the heir to the Roman practice of law and order. Basically, in the Roman Empire, you could do anything you wanted as long as it didn't cause, it didn't disturb the social functioning, the public functioning of the empire. If business was not interrupted, things were fine. If political rule was not interrupted, you could do what you wanted. But if you violated that, if you caused a disruption in the social order, prevented business as usual from taking place, raised questions about the stability of Rome's political and military rule of a region, that invited a great deal of trouble, and that created an environment of law and order where the maintenance of that law and order was the principal and overriding goal. Now, that has brought us, of course, many benefits that we wouldn't want to give up today. And that's a whole... I've taught classes in this in a high school setting on the development of the American political system, which goes back to the Roman Empire and its emphasis on law and order. The rule of law as opposed to the rule of an individual according to their whims and wishes has created for us great freedoms that are precious, and we should hold them dear and make sure we protect them and keep them, because it has given us a greater degree of freedom and comfort than the world has really ever seen, and those are positive things that we have obtained from our culture that didn't necessarily take place in the Eastern world, or are only now in some cases beginning to take place in the Eastern world. If you consider the last absolute monarch on the face of the earth was the Tsar of Russia until the revolutions that took place in Russia in 1917 that deposed the Tsar and then brought about the rule of the Bolsheviks. But prior to that time, the Tsar basically was the last unchecked monarchical power on the earth. There are monarchs today ruling countries around the world, but for the most part, they're constitutional monarchies and not absolute monarchies. What that means is they rule subject to the consent of the people constituted in their parliamentary body, whether parliament in England, some sort of elected assembly like the United States Congress. Keeping a check on the executive power of the monarch. All of that development, you see this in the West, you see it less frequently and later in the East, in part because of the way things changed in the West and did not change in the East with the disappearance of the Roman Empire and the focus on law and order. So these are some of the things that have taken place that lead us to see things in the church in a particular way. And so we do it unconsciously and don't always then think of how they might be different, and then when we encounter that difference, it touches our inherent conservatism. We joke sometimes to say one of the worst things you can hear in the church is, but we've always done it that way, and indeed that's true of larger than the church, but it seems to be particularly important in the church life, and that gets down to the level of moving a picture from one side of the room to the other side of the room, but it's always been over there. Trivial things that can cause problems, and yet we need to sometimes they need to be done, and we need to be aware that we have that tendency, we have that desire to keep the pattern set, make things predictable, make things reliable. And when you have change, that's unpredictable and unreliable until we get used to it, until we see what's going on with it. And so as we encounter these things, as we're going to encounter going through the teachings of the Orthodox Church that are contrary to Western experience, it's going to bring about that sort of dynamic in our own minds, and we have to be aware of that and be prepared to kind of hold that off, push that to one side, that why are we changing things? Why is this different? I don't like it because it's different. We have to be aware that we have the tendency to make that sort of response and to kind of override that, use our brains and our minds to say, okay, I acknowledge that it's different, but there may be a reason for that difference. Let's find out what that is, and then we can make a decision as to whether or not we agree or disagree with what's going on. One of the other things that needs to be touched on in our walk back through history is a development that took place that in part may have been a contributing factor to the Reformation in the church, because it led to a lot of changes and questions that are parallel, consistent with the way Luther and others challenged the Roman Catholic Church and its teachings and practices in the West. And that event, which really doesn't have a hard date because it took place in different ways and at different times in different places, generally recognized as beginning in Italy, but spreading from there both east and west, and I'm talking there about the Renaissance. The Renaissance, the word itself, Renaissance, means rebirth. It's a birth again, you know, a rediscovery of things that had been lost, or a departure, radical departure into a new direction that hadn't been followed before. Renaissance means rebirth. And we need to ask the question when we talk about the Renaissance, we consider its impacts, because its impacts have been incredible, especially in the Western world. They've given us all sorts of things, changes in art, the way paintings are done, changes in sculpture, changes in science, in some respects. Western science begins with the Renaissance, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Reasons why that is true, primarily from our perspective and in what we're considering here. Renaissance means rebirth. The rebirth of what? The rebirth of paganism after 1,000 years of Christian teaching. A 1,000 years plus, because in some cases it was, 1,300 years, 1,400 years of Christian teaching. It's as it's usually presented, the Renaissance is seen as a rediscovery by scholars in Italy and in other places as the Renaissance moves north, south, east, and west from the Italian peninsula. The Latin scholars and the Greek scholars who had fallen into disuse, whose works had been discouraged, even hidden, in some cases, they may have been proscribed by the church and their works burned where they could be found. But a rediscovery of these teachings, perspectives on things, that brought new insight to the people who were discovering them after 1,000 years of Christian teaching. But what were they doing? Not debating the intellectual merits of the Renaissance at all, but looking at it from a church point of view, it was a casting aside of the Christian teaching. Some examples, and these are minor examples. If you look at a Western painting, it's almost like looking, in some respects, at a photograph. One of the defining characteristics early on of the Renaissance was the discovery, quote-unquote, of perspective and putting that perspective into the painting. So you had light and shadows, you had depth. These were things that were not classically found in pre-Renaissance paintings. But there's a story behind that doesn't usually get told in the ordinary teaching of history that we would encounter in school, and probably rightly so. I mean, no reason to take issue there in that particular regard. But what was the purpose of art prior to the Renaissance? A lot of the official art, certainly. If you look at an icon in an Orthodox church, you'll notice that it is not a normal-looking picture. It is not looking at a photograph. It generally tends to lack perspective. It generally does not tend to always closely resemble the human form in a way that we would expect in a photograph or in a Western work of art. Part of the difficulty here in describing it is that, of course, an icon is not a work of art. It's an object that is involved in Orthodox worship. The worship services, not worship of the icon itself, but worship. And we'll consider icons in more detail later on. But you have this change in the perspective on an intellectual basis, where if you lack an understanding of the purpose of an icon, which is to depict an otherworldly reality, and therefore is not going to be painted in such a way that it looks like the world around us, it's not meant to convey that meaning, that was the purpose of art, was to glorify God and to show forth heavenly things as an encouragement to those of us who are on earth. And when you get away from the Christian teaching in these areas and begin to introduce different aspects to it, you're changing the environment in which we live and the understanding of the faith we have, and not necessarily always in a good way. And certainly there has been a development across time since the Renaissance of a decline in certain things in art to lead about to a degrading of human being, a degrading of the concepts of religion. Generally, when you put paganism back in, you're not going to get good things out of it. Another area of impact, another area was important in the Renaissance and its impacts, were changes in the sciences and, as a result, the changes in faith. Scientific inquiry, the scientific method, comes out of the Renaissance, and this is generally recognized as a good thing. And it is not, as some Christian groups would like to proclaim, it is not antithetical or opposed in any way to religion, but it does have impacts, and we need to be aware of those impacts. At the time of the Renaissance, of course, you had universities that were being established. Prior to that time, there was a great flowering of universities, centers of study that were comprehensive and indeed seeking to be universal, covering every aspect of human being and the ability of humans to know at these universities. But in that setting, prior to the Renaissance, the queen of the sciences was theology. And if you look at the word theology, you find it shares a common ending with biology, sociology, anthropology, that word, it's a combination of the word theos, God, and logos, knowledge of, and so theology was knowledge of God, as sociology, anthropology is, knowledge of man, and biology is knowledge of living things. And so the point of the sciences in that pre-Renaissance setting, under the influence of Christian teaching, was to glorify God, and so theology was the queen of the sciences, because everything else was an aspect of what God had created, and God, having created, revealed himself in his creation in certain ways, and so the study of the things that God had done glorified God and gave us better grounds for glorifying God, and that made theology the queen of the sciences. This begins to change as science is pursued, the knowledge of science by itself and not in connection with a means of glorifying God. And so the scientific method becomes the principal way of learning in the Renaissance period. And the scientific method, if you're not familiar with it, begins with you look at something and wonder, how does this work? And immediately with how does this work, it shows us a Western influence as opposed to the why question. We have a how question. How does this work? And then you develop a hypothesis, and then you test that hypothesis, and based on the results of that test, you either confirm or need to modify your hypothesis until you get to a mechanism that is workable, that explains how the process takes place, whatever it is that you're interested in, and it does so in a way that others can test by following the same steps that you followed and getting the same results that you got. This is the basis for our scientific knowledge today. No matter what it is in science, it has grown out of this scientific method of hypothesization, testing, observation, and then reevaluation to give us a theory or even law of science that says, this is how it works. The scientific method is limited to what can be seen, what is observable, what can be tested. It has to have something that returns knowledge that can be sensed, that can be perceived by our minds. There's a principle in physics that I like simply because of the twist in it. It says, a difference which makes no difference is no difference. You have to be able to set up the same kind of conditions and run the same kind of test and get the same kind of observations to verify a scientific theory or a hypothesis. If you can't see it, it doesn't happen. If you can't find it, if you can't test it, it's not real. It's not accepted in the same way as something that is testable and observable. As a result of the scientific method being limited to what can be observed and tested, it's unable to speak about first causes. And this comes back to my own personal discovery about the Big Bang Theory, because science cannot test it. It cannot make a definitive statement about it, and so what you get is a statement of faith. Now, that statement of faith is presumably based on good science, but it is working backwards rather than working forwards as the scientific method requires. However, in this environment where pagan teaching is coming in and being placed on a par with Christian teaching as takes place as the Renaissance spreads, what you have is a development of science as an independent discipline. And again, in itself, that's not bad. There is a great deal of scientific findings that supports what the church believes and teaches and what we practice as a result. And there are other things that we believe and practice that are not affected by changes in what science discovers. But what we have in this Renaissance period, as we're looking at the situation in history, science begins to replace faith, which is to say, people begin to replace faith in God and put their faith in science. So the world in which we live today, where the existence of God himself and the teachings of the churches are increasingly open to criticism, and that criticism often being based on scientific observations, we see a fruit of the Renaissance in the world around us today. And indeed, the scientific method requires almost a form of skepticism. I won't believe it unless I can demonstrate it myself. We could make an obviously stupid example would be to say, I don't believe in gravity until I test it myself. And then you can pick up something and drop it, and then you say, okay, gravity works. I've tested it, but I don't have to take someone else's word for it. I know that it exists by my own observation. This challenges our faith. That skepticism makes it easy to question and hard necessarily sometimes to answer. And we'll have more to say about this later on. But this is one of the things that has taken place in history, in our Western culture. To be honest and fair, it's not exclusive to Western culture. This was taking place in a lot of the Islamic world as well. But we see this change to shape a culture in which we live today, and we take these things for granted. We need to be aware of why we're skeptical. We need to be aware of why our culture looks the way it looks, in order to be able to make sure that we can suspend that automatic response that takes place below the conscious level in many respects, as we encounter the things that we're going to be going through over the next 12 sessions. And begin to build an understanding of the Orthodox Church and faith. I think that that covers the ground I wanted to get through today. I hope that you find it useful and instructive. Again, if you have questions, please feel free to contact me, and we can examine those in more detail. Otherwise, God bless you, and I know I talk fast and I cover a lot of ground. Please feel free to listen to this as many times as you'd like. And then I'll see you for our next session, where we'll continue with the process of becoming aware of our cultural situation with regard to approaching the faith, and begin to explore some more of the Orthodox Christian faith and teachings. May God bless you and help you and keep you safe until we're together again. Amen.